Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Married Women Who Love Women and More by Karen Strock, narrated by Daniela Accitelli. Epigraph. Whether women who love women are born or choose to be is not the issue. It is that we are. Joanne Llewellyn. Poem. The Light. In the plainness of her words, I hear the echo of women calling out in their darkness, listening for answers to questions never voiced, touched by feelings newly felt. And I laugh in recognition within myself. Ah, yes. The secret place where I once lived alone, without answers, and only loud questions. Jane Ferg, July 13, 1940 through February 11, 1990. Forward to the Classic Edition. This book is a gift to all of us. There's a reason that Karen Strock's amazing Married Women Who Love Women and More is now being recognized as a classic, 25 years after it first came out. It's because there are profoundly interesting and moving stories here, but most importantly, it is personal, straightforward, and real. It allows people to connect emotionally and offers life lessons for everyone. You'd think that a book with this title would be steeped in secrecy, delving into an unknown, unspoken world of furtive longings, clandestine meetings, and a lot of heartache. But it isn't. The great surprise is how Karen carries the highest values of honesty and integrity throughout. In her own life and in the lives of those real women whose stories she tells, the astonishing bravery of truth-telling comes through. We're all aware of how the world has changed for LGBTQ+ people. Just about 30 years after the 1969 Stonewall Rebellion came the start of the modern LGBTQ+ liberation movement. Multitudes out of the closet are assuming respected roles of leadership in business, government, education, and sports, and are demanding an equal place in the world. But this was just the beginning. Those of us who fall into this category weren't allowed to legally marry, and all of the other rights of married couples were denied us. We were still 3 years away from the first legal marriages, which happened in the Netherlands in 2001, although there have been reports of same-sex unions throughout recorded history. The United States had adopted the Defense of Marriage Act in 1996 to forbid legal recognition of same-sex marriages, which didn't exist at the time, and non-discrimination laws that cover sexual orientation and gender identity were rare. Now, in 2023, same-sex marriage is legal in 33 countries around the world. The movement for respect and human and legal rights for LGBTQ+ people is active and growing in every country of the globe. Public commentators have become much smoother in talking about us. As the saying goes, the love that dares not speak its name has become the love that won't shut up. Yet dozens of countries still criminalize homosexuality, and some even mandate the death penalty for those convicted of practicing it. And non-discrimination laws in the United States currently exist in fewer than half the states and have been rejected over and over again as national law. Every single day, LGBTQ+ people have to live with the knowledge that much of the world's population still hates us and wants us to disappear. I think we underestimate that burden and how heavy it is to carry. 25 years later, it can still be difficult to be openly and comfortably LGBTQ+. What has always struck me about our identities is that we come to knowledge of them in a personal vacuum. We may see out people in the news or in our schools and businesses or in our families and friend groups. It seems like such role models would make coming out easier, but each of us has to become personally and privately aware of our feelings and who we are. Unfortunately, the stigma largely remains. Where great swaths of the population are screaming that you're sinful and disgusting, and you see bullying and violence being practiced on those people who identify differently. Sometimes today it feels like we're going backward, not forward. Dozens of bills have been proposed all over the United States to punish any mention of LGBTQ+ in classrooms and libraries. Transgender people are literally fighting for their lives, and we are all afraid that the U.S. Supreme Court is about to take away what rights we have. So how could the women in this book, whether they began to have an inkling about their feelings in their youth or their adult lives, have thought that doing anything but marrying a man was an option for them? And once married to those men, how should they have reacted when they then realized they were falling in love with another woman? How could they feel anything but terror, then and now? But here's the magic of this book. It is deeply, insistently, nakedly honest, and so forthright. Karen tells the stories of hundreds of women. She found them through word of mouth, with notes on bulletin boards, notices in lesbian publications, any way she thought she might reach these women. It's not a scientific, randomly controlled trial. It's human stories, and a lot more than she expected to gather when she began her outreach. The stories came pouring in, describing voyages of discovery, the terror and the joy, confusion and mixed feelings. A lot of these women did not leave their husbands, or maybe they left and came back, not cutting off their female lovers, but often integrating them into their lives. In a world where our ignorance and stereotyping would predict entirely different, more tragic outcomes, these women thrill us with their courage. They think about their feelings. They talk to the women they now find themselves loving. They talk to their husbands and their children, and those conversations are vividly real, nuanced, and mature. Whatever these women's ages, locations, or economic status, they tell the truth. And the conversations are shockingly non-judgmental, as is Karen. It turns out that when you tell the truth, you're showing respect for yourself and the person you're talking to. Out of that comes an ability to preserve everyone's dignity in a terribly difficult situation. This is not to say that these conversations or negotiating these relationships on all sides is easy. Karen does not underestimate how hard it can be. She emphasizes how difficult it can be to reorganize a family, but she also insists on honesty and mutual respect as really the only path to peace and acceptance. Reading the book and seeing it in action through these simple, straightforward testimonies from so many women is literally thrilling. This is not a book of dry academic theory. It is a visceral exploration of real people's lives, told in a way that makes their lessons accessible and deeply useful. The stories of married women who discover their capacity for loving women and what they decide to do about it may seem like a niche interest area, but that's not true. The obstacles these women face 25 years ago, today, or tomorrow are terrifying. But how they approach and deal with those obstacles is an inspirational model for everyone. We will all be happier if we can follow their examples. Their determination to face all the institutional, familial, and personal terrors placed in their paths, and their magnificent triumphs. Anne Northrup is a veteran journalist and longtime lesbian activist. She worked as an educator on homosexuality at the Hetrick Martin Institute for Lesbian and Gay Youth. and also became active in ACT UP, AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, participating in hundreds of demonstrations and being arrested about 20 times. She has been involved with countless LGBTQ+ organizations and events, and, since 1996, has co-hosted and co-executive produced the television news program Gay USA. Introduction. 2020 or Recap. The request from my editor that I write a third edition of Married Women Who Love Women came as no surprise. So much has changed, and continues to change daily, with regard to the way we think, feel, and, more importantly, understand the issues of sexuality and gender. I realized that the first thing I would need to adapt would be the title for the new edition. When Married Women Who Love Women was published in 1998 and as a second edition in 2008, the title was self-explanatory. You knew that married meant a woman to a man. However, that is no longer true. In 2015, although Wisconsin, Virginia, Oklahoma, and Utah voted against it, same-sex or gay marriage became legal in all 50 states in the United States. And so, the title had to become more specific. As I looked for titles that might have something to do with women married to men but in love with women, I came across books on sexual fluidity, polyamory, open relationships, and transgenders. But little more had been written on the subject of married women who love women, MWLW. Transgender issues had moved to the forefront. For the first edition of Married Women Who Love Women, there were four basic labels being used: lesbian, bisexual, gay, and straight. In 2001, as the transgendered community made its voice heard, the NYC Gay and Lesbian Center, wanting to be inclusive, changed their name to the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender, LGBT Center. In 1948, sex researcher Alfred Kinsey noted that many people's sexual behavior was somewhere in between exclusively heterosexual and exclusively homosexual. 60 years later, in 2008, psychologist and feminist Lisa Diamond got people talking about sexual fluidity. And with talk of sexual fluidity coming to the forefront, the acronym LGBTQQIAPP, lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer, questioning, intersex, asexual, pansexual, and polysexual, might be more appropriate than LGBT. See Chapter 11 and Glossary for more on this. I had no intention of writing an academic text or a research study when I began my book in the early 1990s. My aim was to let women who had discovered or come to terms with their sexual orientation know they were not alone, and at the same time give me a greater understanding of what I was personally going through, having had no clue to my same-sex sexuality until I was 44 years old. For the first edition, the Internet had not yet become an everyday part of life, and so, initially, I put ads in bookstores and the few lesbian magazines I could find, and I made up simple flyers. While the flyers specifically requested married women for the book, divorced women who had discovered their lesbianism either before or after their divorces also came forward to share their stories. And, although I left the flyers only in the NYC area, they took on a life of their own. Women copied them and sent them to friends across the country. One Virginia woman invited me to stay at her house so that I could personally interview all of the women she knew who were MWLW. Interviews with women in other parts of the country were conducted over the phone. Whenever possible, though, mainly in the tri-state area, I met face-to-face with the women I was interviewing, usually over coffee in a diner. I also constructed a spreadsheet with specific data that each woman filled in for comparisons. Much has also changed since I made my own discovery and embarked on my journey. Locating women to interview for the third edition almost three decades later has been considerably less complicated thanks to the internet. The majority of women interviewed in the early 1990s were between their mid-30s and their mid-50s when their same-sex feelings became apparent. 30% were 35 or younger, 60% were between the ages of 36 and 55, and 10% were over 55. Now, in addition to much younger women coming out, the term late-onset lesbianism has become popular, as more older women are also coming out. These women, for the most part, grew up knowing that they were supposed to marry nice men who would be good providers and good fathers. The unspoken message was, a woman cannot take care of herself. Furthermore, sex outside marriage was considered taboo, and so nice girls married. The single career woman was still an anomaly. Having accepted their culturally sanctioned roles as caregivers and nurturers, some women believed they had no choice other than to remain in their marriages and keep their feelings and needs repressed. Fear of repercussions, having their children taken from them, being shunned by family and friends, even becoming destitute, made other women decide to stay married. All these women silently endured the guilt and anguish brought on by the frightening discovery of their new sexuality. Due to the clandestine way in which MWLW often lived, few people had been aware that they even existed. Consequently, it was understandable that researchers concluded that these women tended to divorce immediately on learning about their sexuality. And who would contradict them? Nonetheless, I knew that not all MWLW left their marriages, and I set out to explore all the ways in which women who love women led their lives. Married women discovering or reawakening their dormant sexual awareness generally fell into four categories. 1. Women who, as young girls, sensed a difference between themselves and their peers but didn't have the words to describe their differences. They had no knowledge that there was any such thing as lesbianism. 2. Women who knew positively early in life that they had lesbian tendencies. However, because they had been indoctrinated by society's teachings into believing that lesbianism was a sickness or evil, or because they simply wanted to fit into mainstream society, they tried to conform. 3. Women who knew what lesbianism was did not deny their feelings and had even been involved with other women, but thought they were different. They were in such strong states of denial that they never characterized themselves as lesbians. 4. Women who totally believed they were heterosexual until they fell in love with another woman. The first three categories have changed as the topic of lesbianism is no longer hidden, but women are still falling into the fourth category, not knowing about themselves until they fall in love with another woman. Because I briefly shared my story and promised each woman total anonymity, my subjects became comfortable sharing theirs, and my interviews turned into intimate conversations which the women allowed me to tape. One surprising change I found as I worked on the third edition was that several of the women I offered anonymity to refused it. One said, "I worked too hard to be my authentic self, not to be my authentic self." Initially, I interviewed more than 100 women from 27 states. Racially, the majority were Caucasian, although I interviewed other ethnic groups as well. The majority identified as Catholic, then came Jewish, Protestant, Episcopalian, Baptist, Presbyterian, and Lutheran. Some claimed no religion. The majority of responses I received were positive, although one email accused me of leaving African American women out of my study. I had not. While I thought I was able to identify some dialects during phone interviews, I had not asked for ethnicities, and only one woman mentioned being black at that time. Chapter 14, New Beginnings, Lena's Story. Another woman brought up the absence of social class. She was correct. I hadn't asked specifically about social class in my questionnaire or during my interviews, but I did ask about education and discovered that those with higher education seemed more comfortable speaking about their situations. While being openly lesbian is now accepted, in most places, when my first edition came out, that was not so. I was giving a workshop on writing and made some references to how I had written MWLW. One woman stood up and said, "I think that whole subject is disgusting." With that, she collected her notes and walked out of the room, slamming the door behind her. 3 years later, that same woman attended another of my workshops. She came up to me and reminded me of who she was and what she had said. She went on to tell me that she had left her husband and was now living happily with another woman. The Stonewell Inn, a local bar, was one of the few that admitted openly gay people in the 1950s and 1960s. Police raids and payoffs in the gay-friendly bars were routine, but when they raided the Stonewell in 1969, tensions between the NYC police and the residents of Greenwich Village, already tense, erupted, and the gay community fought back. We have come a long way from that brutal raid on the Stonewell Bar, where people were harassed and arrested simply for the crime of being gay. To the 50th anniversary of the Stonewell Rebellion and the World Pride March in 2019, which drew millions of spectators and estimates of 150,000 participants marching or riding on the 150 floats. June is now hailed as Pride Month, and around the country, a month-long series of events including parades, workshops, and symposia take place. For the month, brightly colored rainbow flags adorn Broadway, rainbow stripes adorn the covers of theater playbills, and in subway stations, rainbow-colored service information posters read, "Pride Month, no bigotry, hatred and prejudice at this station any time." But New York is not the only city to support gay rights. While, unfortunately, there is still a lot of hatred or fear toward the gay community, progress toward equality is being made with massive LGBT festivals and parades in cities around the world, the largest ones being held in NYC, Sao Paulo, Amsterdam, Tel Aviv, San Francisco, Toronto, Madrid, and Sydney. And then we have the U.S. women's soccer team and World Cup champions who have taken on a frontline role in social justice causes, advocating for LGBTQ rights, equal pay, and racial justice. "I feel like this team is in the midst of changing the world around us as we live," said their openly gay star player Megan Rapinoe. According to a study being done by David Wyatt, between the years of 1961 and 1970, one gay character was documented on a television show. From 1991 to 2000, gay characters numbered 306. In 2018, the LGBTQ media advocacy group, GLAAD, said the percentage of LGBTQ series regulars on broadcast primetime scripted programming is up to 8.8%. When asked how she did her research for the part of a middle-aged woman discovering her lesbianism, Laura Innes, who played Dr. Carrie Weaver on ER in the early 2000s, said, "I read a book called Married Women Who Love Women. Gay and lesbian-themed films, once shown only in artsy theaters, are now being shown in mainstream theaters. Brokeback Mountain, a movie about two married men in love with each other, made all kinds of headlines in 2006. The term brokeback marriage, a marriage of mixed orientation in which one partner is straight and the other bisexual or gay, was coined from this movie. In an age when lesbians and gay men can live openly in some parts of the country, one might think that brokeback marriages would begin to disappear, but that is not happening. While the average age at which women marry has risen from 20.3 in 1950 to 27.4 in 2017, and younger women in general are growing up with an increased awareness and, having more time to explore, a better understanding of their own sexuality and available life choices, some young women, aware of their preference for women, still elect to marry men. Their reasons may be as basic as medical coverage or fear of rejection by family and friends, since societal pressures still restrict many young women, especially those outside of urban areas. In the early 1990s, most books about lesbians or on the subject of lesbianism were published by small presses. For the general public, chances of buying a book from one of the large chain bookstores in which a lesbian was realistically portrayed were slim. Except for the books of Rita Mae Brown, Lisa Alther's Other Women, Margaret Earhart's Unusual Company, and biographies about celebrated women who loved women, such as Vida Sackville-West, Virginia Woolf, Margaret Mead, and Eleanor Roosevelt, there was little chance of finding books with lesbian content. The few that were available were relegated to women's New Age and independent bookstores. These small shops also served as information centers. Their bulletin boards brimmed with women-related happenings and available resources for women in transition. As the major chain stores realized how lucrative the gay market was and made gay theme books more available, many of the small establishments were forced to fold. Now Amazon is creating the same challenge for the few remaining major chain bookstores. The ways in which we communicate have changed even more drastically than the ways in which we shop. In the early 1990s, women, worried about making phone calls their spouses might question, used payphones instead of their home phones. Then phone cards and disposable cell phones took the place of those public phones, only to be replaced by emails which have taken a back seat to texting. Before the Internet, few national publications could be found that listed resources for lesbians. Now, thanks to the easy access to the Internet and to social media, women can connect with any number of groups or dating sites, and typing in the word lesbian will lead you to literally hundreds of thousands of sites. The emails I receive from women currently reading my book or finding my website, KarenStrock.com, are as poignant as those I received in the 1990s. Their cries for help and understanding is loud. Women write things like, "I find myself drawn back to your book again and again. If it wasn't for you, I'd be a lost soul. I find your book to be a place of safety. I just finished Married Women Who Love Women. I couldn't turn the pages fast enough. It eased my panic faster than even Xanax could. It was a clear connection over the white noise in my head." I have also received mail from women who had no idea about their own sexuality until hearing me speak. One woman said, "My co-workers and friends see me as well-balanced, joyful, loving, and with inner peace. But I've noticed that, although I wanted a happy marriage and children, I never felt attracted to men as other women were. Seeing you those few brief moments on the Sally Jesse Raphael show, I went through a multitude of emotions. I realized that what you were saying applied to me, and everything became clear. I want the connection, the closeness I can only have with a woman. I can't explain it any better than this. I just feel it inside of me." It isn't only women in the United States who are making their voices heard. Women from Australia, Brazil, Colombia, England, Germany, Hong Kong, Indonesia, Ireland, Israel, Mongolia, New Zealand, the Philippines, Slovakia, South Africa, and Switzerland have emailed me as well. For the second edition, published in 2008, I emailed my request for subjects to a few women's groups with which I had become familiar. Women again stepped in to help, but instead of making photocopies and snail mailing, they now emailed my requests to other group lists and to friends both nationally and internationally. Within a day or two, many women were responding. When I originally wrote Married Women Who Love Women, I focused primarily on the women in marriages and how they dealt with husbands and children and coped with double lives. But there was another very important part of the picture that I had inadvertently...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?